paying the server costs. Obviously, like, it's going to go out of capacity in 2014, whether or not... 2024, sorry. Whether or not you have Interactive Studio, the studio moves...
Think about it. Did it make sense? Okay, folks. Let's get settled in. So I hope you're working on the case. Hey? Because it is due a week from today, before 10:30, a week from today. So just remember, the clock is ticking. And remember again what I said last week, it's focus on what changes, not what does not. Again, it sounds mysterious, but it'll come. When you get stuck on a question, stop and ask that question. Is this something I should be paying attention to? Is this something that's changing? The second is, remember, there's a big difference between thinking like an accountant and thinking from a financial analysis perspective. Right? There are lots of accounting issues you can get stuck on. Issues like depreciation, allocation, they affect earnings and invested capital and return on capital. But if that's not what your decision is going to be based on, don't spend too much time on accounting judgments, right? Ultimately, your job is to decide whether to take the project or not. Don't hedge, don't bullshit, just do it, right? Once, about 5 years ago, I made the mistake of making the case about Nike, and half the case analyses came back with the same title. You know what it was, right? Just do it. That was my mistake, you know? That kind of tilted the, because you can't even tell Nike, don't do it, because it goes so counter to just do it. You can't say, just don't do it, no? So keep that in mind. So what I'd like to start with today is what I ended with in the last session. If you remember, I was talking about how exposed the Vale iron ore mine is. Excuse me. The Vale... Everything gets magnified when you're wearing a mic. Phlegm moving up and down, it just sounds disgusting. I'm truly sorry. I cannot help it. No? Okay. So we talked about the fact that this iron ore mine that Vale was thinking about investing in Canada was extremely exposed to iron ore prices. And we were talking about, should you hedge it? You know, you understand what I mean by hedging, right? You're a commodity company. You can go in and lock in the prices for future years using the futures market. What's the benefit of hedging? Right. Your earnings get smoothed out, right? That's basically it. What's the cost of hedging? You lose some upside. There's also a direct cost if you buy options. What else? You're doing something your investors might not want you to do, right? Which is, if you're an oil company, I invest in an oil company, we talked about this, I want you to move with oil prices. Otherwise, why am I investing in you? So by going in and undercutting me, you might actually make me, the reason for my investing is gone. So it's kind of, with output, you can see why this is a troubled question, which is, should commodity companies hedge output risk? The answer is generally not. But there was a second macro variable that the mine was exposed to, which is exchange rates. And here's why. The mine is in Canada. All the costs are in Canadian dollars. All the output is going to be sold into a global marketplace in US dollars. In the original analysis, I assumed an exchange rate of one Canadian dollar for one US dollar because that's what the exchange rate was then. And then we talked about what happens if the Canadian dollar gets weaker. What happens if the Canadian dollar gets weaker? Is Vale helped or hurt by that? Why? If the Canadian dollar gets weaker, their costs in Canadian dollars essentially stay the same. But from a dollar, US dollar perspective, their costs have gone down. They still sell into a global marketplace. So a weaker Canadian dollar helps them and a strong Canadian dollar hurts them. So now let's turn to that question. We kind of decided to think that Vale should not hedge output risk. It should not hedge iron ore prices. But should it hedge exchange rates risk? Half of all risk management around the world is around exchange rate. Should you hedge exchange rate risk? Let's go through this template, right? This is actually the template I use. Whenever I get confused about should I hedge a risk, this is where I'm going to go. First question I'm going to ask you is, what's the cost of hedging this risk? If you can hedge this risk costlessly, then I'm not going to make an issue. Go ahead and hedge. Who cares? There are some currencies where getting exchange rate protection is very low. So you say, okay, you want to protect yourself, go ahead. It's only when hedging against exchange rate risk becomes larger, which is going to be the case if you have Brazilian reais or Indian rupees, because you might have to create what I call synthetic futures. Because in Indian rupees, you can buy protection 1 year out, but you will not be able to buy protection 10 years out. You might have to go buy that protection from somebody. They're going to charge you. They're going to charge you 2, 3%, 3.5% to do the hedging. Now let's look to see whether we should go ahead. If you hedge that risk and the cost is high, I'm going to ask you, what's the benefit you're getting from hedging this risk? And I'm not going to let away with the smoother earnings alone. You got to tell me how smoother earnings helps me as an investor. Okay? And if you do, here are two pathways you can use. One is you can say, maybe by smoothing out earnings, you pay less in taxes. You're saying, why would that be? Let's say you have a tax code where the tax rate increases if you make more than $50 million. So you're the kind of company whose income spikes in good years, it goes to 80 million, bad years, it goes to 10 million. By smoothing out your earnings, what do? You keep your earnings below the 50 million. So maybe your argument is, by hedging, I save on taxes. That's the first argument. Here's the second one. Smoother earnings by itself is not a big deal. I can live with volatile earnings. So when I invest in an oil company, as I did in Lukoil, I know my earnings are going to be up and down. I welcome it. That's why I invest in Lukoil. Because I think eventually oil prices will go back up and my investment is going to pay off. That's my hope. But you know what scares me? Is if you have an oil company with a lot of debt, and I invest in you now expecting oil prices to bounce back, and they go down first before they bounce back, what am I worried about? That you might not make it to see the good times. Nirvana will come, but you won't be there. I'll be alone saying, where's my investment? So the second argument you can make for hedging is, by hedging, I reduce the risk of default. So if you're a levered oil company, a levered gold mining company, that's an argument for hedging. There's a third argument. Managers get worried, right? They get ulcers, they get heart attacks. And if they start thinking about exchange rates all the time, guess what's going to happen? They're going to be rejecting good projects because they're scared. Food processing companies in the U.S., Heinz, you can go down the list, Hershey's. These are old companies with established products, great brand names. For a long time, they would not invest outside the U.S. Why? Because they were family-run companies, not family-owned companies. They were public companies, but the family did not like the blowback that came from exchange rate risk, so they would not invest in Asia, would not invest in Latin America. That's not good. If your good investments are all in Asia and Latin America, I want you investing there. And if I can get you to do that by hedging away exchange rate risk, then that's a benefit as well, because now you're taking projects you otherwise wouldn't have. Those are three very real benefits: a tax benefit, a survival benefit, and a better decision benefit. So when I ask you, why do you hedge? I want you to come up with one of those reasons. There's also a surface reason. You can say, look, I have more stable earnings. Complete the story. How does that help me as an investor? I don't collect earnings. So tell me how more stable earnings could potentially pay off for me as an investor. What's the rest of the story you need to tell me? companies with stable earnings get priced at a higher price. You'd have to tell me that story, right? They have higher PE ratios, and investors like stable earnings. They will price you at 20 times earnings with stable earnings rather than 15 times earnings, so you're going to see the benefit. And if I have any good sense, what should I ask you for? Proof. I've heard investment banks make this claim all the time. You know how much proof exists for this claim? Zero, none. You're going to use it. If you go work for an investment bank, you guys will be using this claim. Just be glad that there is somebody not on the other side with a good sense to ask you, show me the proof. But if you're going to make that claim, at least back it up. Show me that in your sector, companies with more stable earnings trade at 20 times earnings and more volatile earnings trade at 15 times earnings. But I want to see a benefit, and that benefit has to be greater than the cost. But I'm not quite done. So let's say you have a risk you can hedge. There is a significant benefit. Then I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Can the marginal investors in your company hedge this risk at a lower cost than you? What am I talking about? Who are the marginal investors in Disney? BlackRock, State Street, Fidelity. What happens to exchange rate? Are they affected by exchange rate risk? Those investors? They have 100 companies, right? Or 200 companies in their portfolio. When the dollar goes up, what happens to the price of those companies? Some go up. Some go down. Collectively in their portfolio, they might say, I don't care about exchange rate risk. It all washes out. Do you see why I'm so skeptical about companies hedging all these risks? Because the investor in these companies can hedge those risks almost costlessly by creating portfolios. So why do I need each of you to go out and pay an investment banker to hedge that risk for me when it's all going to disappear in my portfolio? So if marginal investors can hedge this risk cheaper than you can, you should just let the risk pass through and let them take care of it. You'll get pushback from managers because they so want to make this risk go away. And the problem is you let the risk hedging salesman in, they're going to tell you all the good stuff, but 90%, and this is just my personal view, 90% of all the risk that's hedged out there, you have no business hedging. You're doing it because it makes you as a manager feel good. It has nothing to do with shareholders. You have no problem. You have no money. You are just a manager of a company holding money for your investors. So when you say you, I'm not sure who you is.
As a manager, you're still going
to... You will lose your job. It's not you that I'm worried about. If you can show me that there's a default risk that will affect me, it's not about you. You're losing your job. I don't care. You know why I don't care? Because I pay you $3 million to be my CEO. You're getting sufficiently compensated for being a manager. So if going out of business scares you so much, my advice is find a different business to work in. This is about you. If you can show me that going out of business is going to affect me as an investor, that's that survival benefit, then I'm willing to listen. So as a manager, here's your job. If you feel that by not hedging the risk, you could go under, then you have to tell me how much my investment is affected and say, look, this is how much we lose in value by not hedging. This is how much we're gaining. We have to hedge to survive because we don't survive. You lose money, you being the investor. So the focus always has to stay on the investor. It can't be about, as managers, you feel more comfortable hedging the risk. So take any risk out there, interest rate risk, the number of products you have to manage risk, just grow every year. If you wanted to, you could go and buy protection against pretty much every risk you can think of, but you got to be selective. When I think about risk management, this to me is at the core of good risk management, is every company has to decide which of three buckets to put its risks in. Some risks you should hedge, for whatever reason, distress. Some risk you should pass through, let your investors take care of it. And some risk you should actually seek out and try to get more of. Why would you do that? Because that's how you run a business. There are some risks where you're better than others at taking that risk. You want to find that. That's what corporate strategy is all about, finding those risks where you have a competitive advantage and going out there and exposing yourself to those risks. Yes? First, let's be very clear. Who's you?
As an investor.
As an investor.
It doesn't all depend upon what you think, whether the market
It doesn't matter. If I'm worried about let's keep the focus on exchange rates. Let's have a view on exchange rates, right? Do I want you to be carrying out your view, or do you want me to, as an investor? See, all I'm saying is leave me the option of whatever my views are on exchange rates, reflecting that both in my portfolio and what I do with my portfolio. Because I can go hedge my portfolio if I wanted to, right? And I will be buying far fewer hedges than you would be because I have 100 stocks in my portfolio. So I'm saying whatever your view is, all I'm saying is you have to leave it to the investors, because if you step in and do it for me, then you might be doing something I don't want you to do, right? You might be hedging against the US dollar when I think the US dollar is going to get stronger rather than weaker. Why should you make that judgment for me? And that's all I'm saying. If it's a private business, then of course you have every freedom to do whatever you want to hedge. But in a public company, you have to think about what would investors want me to do. So I'm not saying you cannot hedge, but it's going to be in a very small subset of cases that you decide to go and hedge risk. Any questions? So this is, take any other risk and pass it through this framework. Take a real company. Say, should this company be hedging? And it's going to give you the framework to assess whether you should be going out and buying protection. So now let's talk about the final product. So we've talked about the Disney theme park. We've talked about the Vale iron ore mine. There's a third investment I want to talk about. And this is a very unconventional investment. It's a big acquisition. You say, but an acquisition is not an investment. Why not? You spend a lot of money up front. You get a big company in return. This is a big project, right? So I'm going to set up a hypothetical acquisition. And in this acquisition, I'm going to do everything I did in a traditional project. I'm going to estimate cash flows, come up with a discount rate, take the present value, and I'm going to tell you the net present value of this acquisition is X dollars. And what's the rule on net present value? The net present value, net present value is less than zero, don't take the investment. If the net present value is greater than zero, take the investment, right? I'm going to apply the same rule when it comes to acquisitions. And everything I said about individual projects will affect, I'm going to think the same way with acquisitions. What kind of cash flow should we be looking at when we look at traditional capital budgeting projects? Incremental cash flows, right? I'll do the same thing with acquisitions. What discount rate should I use for a project? Whatever discount rate reflects the risk of that project, not the risk of the company taking the project, I'm going to use that same rule. So the investment I'm going to look at, the acquisition I'm going to look at, is an acquisition where Tata Motors is considering acquiring Harman International. Harman Audio, you've seen they're expensive up. Why does Tata Motors want to do it? There's synergy. You think, where's the synergy in acquiring an audio manufacturer? Well, remember, increasingly cars, if you look at the kinds of stereo systems, the sound systems, you want high-grade systems. And Tata Motors is convinced that by buying Harman, they can upgrade the audio in their cars and perhaps sell more cars. So there's a talk of synergy. I'm initially going to value Harman without the synergy. Then I'll come back and talk about how much is synergy worth. I'm going to talk about how should Tata Motors value Harman. And everything I say in the next 5 minutes is what I do over a whole session on acquisitions. And if you're going to work in M&A, this is pretty much the core of how we think about valuation. So here's the first thing I'm going to do. I have to decide a currency I'm going to value Harman in. Remember, currency is a choice. I can say, look, I'm an Indian company, Tata Motors, therefore I want to do everything in Indian rupees. But that's going to be a lot of work because I have to take Harman's numbers, which are all in US dollars, convert them into rupees and do the discounting. And since you're going to get the same answer anyway, I'm going to do the easier route, take the easier route and do everything in US dollars. Where's that going to show up? My risk-free rate is going to be a US dollar risk-free rate. For the beta, I'm not going to use the betas I estimated for Tata Motors because it's not in the audio business or the high-end audio business. I'm going to use the beta for electronics companies of 1.17 as my beta for Harman. Notice that I'm now looking at what I'm acquiring, not what I already have. For the equity risk premium, remember I computed an equity risk premium for Tata Motors based on where it does business? That's not where I'm looking. Here I'm looking at where Harman does its business, and based on its revenues around the world, the equity risk premium I'm going to use is 6.13%. You think, when is Tata Motors even going to enter into the picture? Never. This is about valuing Harman, so I'm going to focus entirely on Harman. US dollars, I'm using a beta for Harman, I'm using an equity risk premium for Harman, and I'm going to complete the process. When I did my debt ratio and cost of capital, I used Harman's debt to capital ratio and Harman's cost of debt. Yes? We talked about this, right? You go global when you have to. I had to for theme parks. Remember, I had to go 26 global companies. I mean, you might start by looking in the U.S., and we get enough companies that why go looking for trouble? I have everything against the same index, but you don't have to. Yeah. You can go global. You can bring them all into your sample. Okay. Last piece, I'm going to use the debt ratio and the cost of debt for Harman. And that gives me a cost of capital in U.S. dollar terms of 9.67%. Nothing in this calculation brings in Tata Motors numbers in, because it doesn't even really matter if I'm valuing Harman Audio as a standalone company. So that's my cost of capital. That's what you're going to see as my discount rate. To get my cash flows, I'm going to keep it simple. The operating income that Harman had in the most recent year was about $201 million. And that, you know, I got by making sure that I took out all those one-time items. I didn't want them affecting my value. So the $201 million is my base case operating income. And in 2013, Harman had depreciation of $128 million and capital. So notice these are all items I used in the theme park as well, but now they're much bigger because I'm looking at an entire company. Finally, the change in working capital each year is going to be about 13.5% of revenues. Those are my base year numbers. So I have the cost of capital for the company, I have the numbers for the most recent year. Now here's how I'm going to value Harman Audio. I'm going to forget about the synergy and all that stuff. I'll come back and talk about it later. To value Harman, I'm going to make a very simplistic assumption. I'm going to assume that it's a stable company growing at the same rate as the economy forever. And remember we talked about using the risk-free rate as a proxy for that? So 2.75% was my T-bond rate. I'm going to use that as my growth rate forever. I'm also going to assume that their capex and depreciation and net everything is growing at that same rate. Why mature companies? Everything should. My working capital is calculated based on the revenues. So my cash flow 1 year out, which is the cash flow that's going to go into my valuation, is $166.85 million. I'm almost home. I have my cash flows and my growth rate. Yep. The T-bond rate, is it a nominal or a real number? 50-50 shot. I'll help you if you pick the wrong one. I'll make it sound like you picked the wrong one. Just give me one. Nominal. Exactly. Nominal. Right? T-bond rates are nominal. TIPS rates are real. So anytime you use a T-bond rate, it's nominal in U.S. dollar terms. You're saying, what's the currency come in? It reflects the inflation in U.S. dollars. If I'd done rupees, it'd be nominal in rupees, which has a higher inflation rate. So inflation is always embedded in your discount rate through the risk-free rate. And depending on the current, then that's why currencies matter. Different currencies can give you different inflation rates. So I've got my cash flows, I've got my cost of capital, I've got my growth rate. I plug them in. It's perpetual growth, right? Growing perpetuity, cash flow next year divided by cost of capital minus the growth rate, gives me a value for Harman Audio's operating assets of about $2.75 billion. As a standalone company, that's the value that I'd attach to its assets. I add cash because, you know, it's sitting out there and belongs to me. I subtract out the debt. The value that I get for Harman's equity at the time that Tata Motors was looking at it was $2.678 billion. If you bought Harman, the market value would have been $5.428 billion. Should they buy Harman? I'm not going to pass judgment yet because what have I not calculated yet? They're doing this for the synergy. So as long as the synergy is worth at least $2.8 billion, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to come back and value synergy separately. But as a standalone company, synergy doesn't enter into the process. I valued it as based on its cash flows, its risk, and its growth rate. So keep that in mind. When you do acquisitions, you have to think about the target company all of the time. It's not about the acquiring company. It's about the target company. Nothing in the acquiring company should really come into play till you start talking about synergy and all that neat stuff afterwards. This is really about valuing the standalone company as a target company. Any questions? So three projects, we basically looked at each of them as standalone projects. To complete this process, I'm going to talk about what happens when projects are not standalone independent investments. Let me explain what I mean by standalone. When I looked at Disney, the Disney theme park, all I had to decide was take it or don't take it. When I looked at the iron ore mine in Canada, take it or don't take it. And with the acquisition, either acquire or don't acquire. Those are called independent projects. You can look at the cash flows and the present value and be done. But in the real world, projects are almost never completely independent. So what I'd like to talk about is what happens when you have projects that are mutually exclusive. I'll give you an example of a mutually exclusive investment. How many of you are sophomores? Okay, so you're and 7 months ago, you had this offer from NYU, an offer presumably from 4 or 5 other schools, and you had to pick. That's a mutually exclusive investment. Why? Because you can't go to NYU and Yale at the same time. I haven't figured out how to do it yet, but you would. Those are mutually exclusive investments. You decide to put a new flooring in your kitchen. You have to decide linoleum or wood. You have to decide. If you pick linoleum, you can't pick wood. Those are mutually exclusive investments. Why? Because they serve the same purpose, and you have to decide which one's right for you. In hindsight, you might make the wrong choice, but you have to choose. Mutually exclusive. There's another reason investments can be mutually exclusive. When I said you can take a positive net present value project is good, you should take it, I assumed you have the money to take this project. What if you have only a limited amount of capital and you can take only 5 projects? You can't take every positive net present value project, so taking one means you have to reject another, mutually exclusive investments. So what I'd like to talk about is how do you choose between 2 investments or 3 investments or 4 investments, because this is where NPV and IRR can sometimes give you different answers. And we're going to talk about which one to trust if you get different answers using the different approaches. So I'm going to use some very simple examples to illustrate this. And you're going to see that when you're picking projects, first with equal lives, which is the simplest case, so you have 2 10-year projects, 2 5-year projects, you can compute the NPV and the IRR of each investment and compare them. And the NPV rule is simple. Pick the one with a higher NPV. The IRR rule says pick the one with a higher IRR. And I'm going to talk about when you get different answers from the two. And I'm going to ask you why it's happening, why you're getting different rankings, and which one you should pick. So let's start simple. Let's assume you have 2 investments. So there's project 1, there's project 2. Those are the cash flows. Project 1, you spend $1 billion up front. You get $800 million in year 1, $1 billion in year 2, $1.3 billion in year 3. And there's a back-ended cost, a licensing fee you have to pay in year 4 of minus $2.2 billion. Project 2 has $1 billion up front and a more conventional positive cash flow every year for the next 4 years. So I ask you to compute the NPV of each project and the IRR of each project. So I'm going to show you what the NPV profiles look like for these projects, and you tell me whether you notice something strange. Remember, the NPV is where the IRR is that point where the NPV is 0. So for project 2, that happens at around 11%, between 10 and 11. But if I take project 1, there is an IRR around here, and there's a second internal rate of return later in the process. So there's an IRR around 6.6%, another one around 36.6%. Do you see the quandary you face? If your cost of capital is 10%, that's your hurdle rate. If you pick the lower IRR, it looks like a bad project. If you pick the higher IRR, it looks like a good project. So our first question I have is a mathematical question. Why do I have 2 internal rates of return for the first project and only 1 internal rate of return for the second project? I'll show you the cash flows, and you tell me whether there's a clue in the cash flows as to why there's more than 1 internal rate of return. Justin? Well, that's just telling me why I ended up. What is it about the projects that gives you 2 IRRs? I know it plotted a line, it goes down, but what is it about the project? Because usually the second project, it never happens. Yep. That's close, but not enough. If the 2 cash outflows had been in year 0 and 1, and then there'll be only 1 IRR. So it's not the 2 cash outflows. What is it? 2 sign changes. Do you see what I mean? You went from minus to positive, back to, you think, who the hell cares? An IRR is a root to an equation. That's what it is mathematically. We never solve it as such. It's a root to an equation. The cash flows are the numbers that go into the equation. If you have more than 1 sign change, you'll have more than 1 root to the equation. Don't worry, I'm not going to check you mathematically on this. Trust me on this one. If you look at your project And there are negative cash flows in year 0, year 5, year 10, and year 15. And the other cash flows are all positive. You will have 4 internal rates of return for this project, even if you never find it. So it's not your fault. It's the way the cash flows come in. Because the first project has negative and positive cash flows and then goes back to being negative, there are 2 sign changes, there are 2 internal rates of return. So now we know why it happens. It's going to happen any time you have more than 1 sign change. But you still have to decide, right? Take the project or don't take the project. So let me show you what the internal rates of return look like. For project one, the internal rates of return is 6.6 and 36.55%. For project two, it's 12.8%. So we've talked about why you have 2 internal rates of return for project one. It's because you have 2 sign changes. If your cost of capital is 12%, and you're allowed to pick only one of these 2 projects, which one would you pick? See my question? It's 12.8. Go ahead, Roy. Project two? But I would think 36.55% is another IRR, right? Why would I not? Why am I ignoring that? What? No? What if it had been the first one? Is there significance to the second one as opposed to the first one? Why is that significant? Would it matter if it had gone the other direction if the graph had been? So let's say that in this case the graph went this way. What if the graph went this way? Now do you see why when you have more than one IRR, you don't want to even use IRR? Because we can get, you can end up in this completely mechanistic issue of, I'm going to pick one over the other. There's really no good reason. They're both crappy IRRs, we know that. Any contrast? So you're saying, what am I going to do instead? Just compute the damn net present values. You're going to get only one NPV for each project. Pick the one with a higher NPV. So here's my solution to the more than one IRR problem. What if your project is more than one IRR? Don't use IRR. End of problem, move on. There have been entire books on what to do with multiple IRRs. I don't know how you get past page one. Don't use IRR. What's the rest of the book about? It's playing little games, or you can try this, you can try that. You don't have to try anything. If you have more than one IRR, just let it go. It's not working. So that's the first condition under which you can get different answers. If you get more than one IRR, just go with the NPV. Now let's try a second scenario where you're going to get different rankings. Let's say I come to you with 2 projects. They're mutually exclusive again. Project one, you invest $1 million up front and there are your cash flows for the next 4 years. Project two, you invest $10 million up front and there are your cash flows for the next 4 years. Remember, they're mutually exclusive. So I did the NPV for project one and the NPV for project two. NPV for project one is $467,000. The NPV for project 2 is $1.358 million. So if I just pause there and say, which project is a better project 2 is clearly the much better project. But when I do the internal rate of return, I reverse the answers. Project 1 has a higher internal rate of return. Project 2 has a much lower internal rate of return. Why am I getting different rankings with NPV and IRR for these 2 projects? Abigail? You don't know? Want to try? It's very simple. Think about it. I'll give you a clue. IRR is a percentage value. NPV is a dollar value. You want to try?
It's just because the second one's
bigger. Exactly. Net present value is a dollar value. If you have a $100 billion project, the net present value on that project is going to be much greater than a $1 billion project. NPV is going to tilt you towards bigger projects. IRR is going to tilt you towards smaller projects. Which one's better? Should you be tilted towards bigger or smaller projects? It depends. Depends on what? If you're a company with hundreds of billions of dollars in cash, you're a Google or an Apple, then you should go with the bigger project. Cash is not a problem for you. If you're a young startup, then obviously capital is a constraint. You don't have the luxury of saying, I'll take the big project and everything's going to work out, because if you take that big project, it might suck up all your cash. There you might be tilted more towards internal rate of return, because you've got to take care of your capital as carefully as you can, get the biggest bang for the buck. Because if you go for that really big project, then if another great project comes along later in the year, you can't take it. That's what's called a capital rationing constraint. And what I'm saying is, if you have a capital rationing constraint, if you have limited capital, then I understand you're using internal rates of return. You want a percentage return. If you have potentially large capital and not enough projects, then I want you to go towards NPV. And you can think about the company you've picked. Remember the company you're supposed to have picked about 7 weeks ago? Think about it. If you can't think about it, you're in trouble. Think of some other company, then think about it later. Then ask yourself, for my company, would I go with NPV or IRR? Because the answer should be pretty simple. You have a $30 billion cash balance or a $50 billion cash balance. You should be going with NPV. You don't need to kind of ration out your capital. There are companies, though, which have limited capital. Stating the obvious, might as well state it. But if you dig a little deeper and see why you have these capital rationing constraints, a capital rationing constraint basically means you cannot take every positive net present value project. They will tend to be smaller companies rather than larger companies, high growth companies as opposed to mature companies, emerging market companies as opposed to developed market companies. You're going to see more capital rationing constraints, and there the argument for using internal rate of return becomes much stronger. So if you go into companies, most companies will tell you up front they have a capital rationing constraint. Almost every company I've ever gone into says, we have a capital rationing constraint. And if you look at where that capital rationing constraint comes from, in most companies, the capital rationing constraint doesn't come from outside. It's not coming because markets are not giving you money. It's not because you can't raise loans from the bank. It's self-imposed. Managers just don't want to raise capital. They don't want to issue shares because it will dilute their equity. They don't want to borrow money because the bank is going to ask them questions. Most of capital rationing in developed markets is self-imposed. I'm okay with it as long as you recognize that it's a constraint you put on yourself. So NPV or IRR, it depends on who you are. If you're a company with significant capital rationing constraints, so you can see 69% of the companies in the sample of the survey, the capital rationing constraint came from within. Managers impose the constraint. In only about 11% of these companies did the rationing constraint come from outside. So NPV and IRR can give you different answers if you have projects with very different scales. Larger projects, you're more likely to see NPV give you the higher number. Smaller projects, IRR. Now comes the trickiest choice. Oh, incidentally, one way you can actually stay with NPV if you don't like to go with IRR is you can actually take the NPV that you got from your investment and divide by the initial investment and make it's called a profitability index. It's like a scale net present value. So in my example, if I divided the net present value for project A by the investment, I get 46.79%. The way to think about that is for every dollar I invest in this project, I get 46.79 cents in NPV. On the second project, I get only 13.59 cents. Again, a way of saying I want to get the most bang for my buck. Now I'm going to show you what I think is the toughest one to explain away. I'm going to give you two projects with exactly the same upfront investment, $10 million. The cash flow patterns are a little different, but both NPV and IRR are supposedly time-weighted incremental cash flow returns, right? And when I compute the NPV, project 2 looks better than project 1. And I compute the IRR, project 1 looks better than project 2. So what is it about these projects that's giving me different rankings using these two approaches? They're both time-weighted incremental cash flow approaches. Yes, Justin? It's the order of the cash flows, but expand on it. But if they're both time-weighted, then they both weight earlier cash flows more than later cash flows.
The discount rate, the smaller cash flows at the end, uses the least.
You're very close. It's a discount rate, but where does the discount rate come into play? In the net present value, it comes in explicitly, right? No, it affects both. There's discount rates in both IRR and NPV. No, because it's both discount rates compound, so they have to be using different discount rates, right? No, but that's always going to be the case. They're both time-weighted. I agree with you that cash flow patterns matter, but why does one seem to weight those patterns more than others? What happens in year one? I get a cash flow of $5 million, right? When I get that cash flow of $5 million, what do I do with it? I reinvest it somewhere, right? In the cost of capital approach, you know what I assume? In the net present value approach, I assume you reinvested at your hurdle rate, the 8.46%, 9%, whatever your cost of capital is. In the IRR approach, you know what I assume you do? You take that cash flow in year one, you don't invest it at your discount rate, whatever that discount rate is, but you reinvest it at the internal rate of return. So on project one, here's what I'm assuming. I have this great project that makes me 21.41%. I get a cash flow of $5 million in year one. I find another project that's going to also make me 21.41%. I get another $4 million in year two. I invest it at another. So basically, I'm assuming that I can keep finding projects that earn the internal rate of return. That's a dangerous place to be, right? Especially if you have a high IRR project. I'm assuming that not only does this project have a high IRR, but you have a stream of other projects that can deliver the same high internal rate of return. That's called the reinvestment assumption. It's a big assumption that drives both NPV and IRR. The reinvestment assumption in the NPV is that you reinvest at the hurdle rate, at the cost of equity, at the cost of capital. Reasonable because we got that by looking at what other investments of equivalent risk make in the market. But in the IRR approach, I assume you reinvest at the internal rate of return. Private equity investors love to show you IRRs on their investments. So in the next 10 years, we're going to make a 55% IRR. And technically, they're right. They've done it mathematically right. You know the question you need to ask them? So I'm a private equity investor. I get up in front of you and say, hey, look at my cash flows for the next 10 years. The IRR on this project is 55%. What's my weakest link? What do you need to ask me? Don't ask me about this project. You need to ask me, where am I going to find all these other projects for the next 9 years that will also earn me 55%? And I'm going to say, oh, that's not my problem. I just had this project. At which point you have to come back and say, I'm really not going to make 55% on this project. I'm really going to make a lower return. Yeah?
But would the IRR be assuming that the 10-year project, the IRR for the whole 10-year project is 55%?
It is, but the cash flow in year one can't go back into this project. It's got to find another project. That's cash being through. See, remember, you invest in a project. It's a factory. The factory generates cash flows. Well, what are you going to do with it? This is cash flow after you've done. So this is like the Disney theme park. This is the cash flow left over after you've reinvested. It's a cash flow coming out of the project. I can't keep throwing it into the theme park and making it bigger. Projects just don't scale up, right? I just can't make a project 10 times larger and earn the same rate of return. A project does something and it's done. I have to find somewhere else to invest this money. A project is not like a stock where I can reinvest a dividend. A project is a standalone project. And once the cash flows come out, I've got to find some other place to invest those cash flows. If you could reinvest, and that's a question I'm going to ask you. Can you offer me, if you could show me as a private equity investor that this isn't a one-time deal, that you're going to be able to come up with another 55% return project next year, and the year after, and the year after, then I'm okay with it. But the onus is on me then to show you that I have those investment opportunities, that I can find a place for your cash. And that's, I think, the weakest link, because if you don't have those opportunities, this is a once-in-a-lifetime investment, which it often is at a 55% IRR. I'm not going to be making 55% by the end of the 10th year. Okay. Any other questions? So let's summarize why the three rules give you different answers. There can be only one NPV for a project, but there can be many IRRs. Right? Second, when your projects of different scale, NPV is going to bias you towards the bigger projects, IRR is going to bias you towards the smaller projects. And the third is this reinvestment risk assumption. And fundamentally, the reinvestment risk assumption is more dangerous in IRR than it is in NPV because of what I'm assuming I can keep doing year after year after year after year. So all cautionary notes to keep in mind. You can get an NPV and IRR for different projects, but you have to be very careful about just going back and forth between the two, especially if you're choosing between projects, because they do make different assumptions. There is a way in which you can fix the IRR problem, and here's what you need to do. Let's assume you have a project. You have an upfront investment of $1 billion, $300 million year one, $400, $500, and $600 million for the next 4 years. The traditional IRR for this project is 24.89%, but that assumes you can reinvest my cash flow in year one, two, and three at 24.89%. Let's say you don't think you can do that. Let's say you assume that you can earn only the cost of capital on that money. So when you get that money out from the project, it's got to be invested at the cost of capital. And let's say the cost of capital is 15%. Here's what you need to do. You have minus 1,000 up front. You get plus 300 in year one. You would invest it at 15% for the remaining 3 years. Plus 400 in year two, invested at 15% for 2 years. Plus 500 in year three, invested at 15% for 1 year. The 600 is already at the end of the fourth year. So you keep track of what you will get by the end of the fourth year. Collectively, that cash flow is going to work out to 2,160 million, assuming a 15% reinvestment. If you compute your IRR using this as your initial investment and 2160 as your final cash flow, the internal rate of return, it's called a modified internal rate of return because you're assuming you can reinvest at the cost of capital, is lower than it was when you computed the traditional IRR. So if you really want to go down this road, I can give you the tools to compute a modified IRR. It's not difficult to do. But the question is, if you're going to be working this hard to even make your net present value meaningful, I'm sorry, your IRR meaningful, why not just stick with the net present value? So when people contort themselves and do all these crazy things with IRR, often the question you got to ask is, why are you trying so hard to stay with internal rate of return where there's a far simpler alternative, which is the net present value? Any questions about NPV versus IRR? Now, normally in a corporate finance class, you'd spend 3 sessions on NPV versus IRR. Biggest waste of time ever. And here's why. 90 to 95% of the time, NPV and IRR give you the same decision. So if you're really interested in using IRR, you know what I'd say? Welcome to the club. At least you're not using accounting return on capital. It's a time-weighted cash flow return. I'm not going to push you and say, you know, you shouldn't be using IRR. It's a terrible thing to do, an awful way to pick projects. When I was taught corporate finance, my corporate finance class ended with a categorical statement. Companies should use only NPV, never use IRR, because it's fundamentally a sounder way. I agree, it's fundamentally sounder, but it's close enough to IRR that I can accept either. So if you really want to use internal rate of return, you have people use internal rate of return, it's okay. We're agreeing on more things than we disagree. There might be a few ranking differences between us, but for the most part, we'll be picking the same projects. So that's projects with equivalent lives. Now let's talk about projects with different lives. You don't get that many magazine subscription renewal offers anymore, right? Because everybody reads it online. But I remember in the old days, you'd get this card in the mail saying, oh, Time Magazine. It might be entirely online now. Who buys an actual Time Magazine? It'll offer you a chance to renew the magazine, and here's how the offers will go. You can renew it for 1 year at $25. For 2 years, for $48. This is assuming the people who are putting the ad know their math. And 3 years at $69. If you pick purely based on average cost, it's a no-brainer, right? 3 years at $69 is $23 a year. That's less than $24 a year, which is 48 divided by 2. What are you missing when you do that, though? When are you going to pay this money? You're going to pay it right now. Which means that the 23 might not be cheaper than the 25 because you're not factoring in the time value of money. Now, the solution I'm going to offer is not something you should be using on magazine subscriptions. That's overkill. But this can happen on a larger scale. Let's assume I have a project with a 5-year life and a project with a 10-year life. Let's say they're mutually exclusive. You can take one or the other. The 5-year project, here are the cash flows, $400 million for 5 years, $1 billion upfront investment. Project B is $1.5 billion upfront and $350 million for the next 10 years. If I do the net present values of these two projects, I pretty much know what I'm going to find. The longer life project is going to have a higher net present value than the shorter life project. Why? Because of cash flows going on and on and on after year five. The internal rate of return doesn't have the problem because it's a percentage rate of return. But let's focus on the NPV. If I pick based on NPV, it looks like project B is better than project A, but it's unfair to project A because at the end of year five, the project ends. So give me a very simplistic way in which I can fix this problem. I've set up the lives of these projects so the simplistic solution will work. What can I do that will make these two projects comparable? What's the source of the problem? Project B lasts 10 years, project A lasts only 5 years, right? So what could I do? I could take project A and do it 2 times, right? Let's try that. That's called replication. Replication, what you do is you take project one and you do it 2 times. What does that require? $1 billion up front, $400 million for 5 years, $1 billion again at the end of the fifth year because you've got to keep the project going. So now we have two 10-year projects. I can do the net present values of these two projects, and I can compare them. You think this is good, I like this, it's simple. If this is the only way you can do this process, on the quiz, expect a problem where I'm going to ask you to compare a 7-year life project to a 9-year life project. Tell me how long you'll have to replicate these projects to make them both have the same life. You'd have to do the 7-year project 9 times and the 9-year project 7. In other words, you'd have to have 63 years of cash flows on your quiz. Not a great idea if you have 30 minutes to do the quiz. So don't make this your only way of dealing with projects, because all I need to do is give you 2 prime numbers and you're sunk. Okay? So I'm going to give you a second way in which you can deal with projects with different lives. If I can somehow convert the net present value into an annualized number, then you're going to be able to compare it, right? You're saying, didn't we start off by doing that by dividing the 69 by 3? That is an annualized number, but I did not bring in the time value of money. So here's the second way in which you can deal with projects with different lives. Keep them as 10-year projects and 5-year projects. Remember the net present values we got, 442 and 478 million? Take the 442 million net present value that you got for the 5-year project, convert it into a 5-year annuity. Let me talk in calculator language for you. Here's what you're going to be doing. You're going to be entering 442 as your NPV. Your discount rate is 12%, I or R or whatever the corresponding. You're going to put an N of 5 years, then you're going to hit the payment button. That payment will basically take the 442 million, say that's like getting 122.62 million every year for 5 years. Then take the second project, 478 million, hit that as the NPV, enter 12 as your discount rate, N is 10 years, and hit the payment button. What you will get as an annuity is 84. You're saying, what does that mean? If you take project one, that's like getting $122 million a year. If you take project two, that's like taking $85 million a year. These are annual numbers. You can compare them. And based on that comparison, project A is better than project B. You will get exactly the same answer that you got with replication. But it's a lot less work. It's actually a very good technique to have, especially if you become a homeowner. I'll tell you why. You're a homeowner, your heating system blows up, December 12th. Middle of winter, it blows up. You got to replace it with a new heating system. The heating system guy comes in with 3 systems. I can sell you a really cheap system. The last 5 years will cost you $5,000. I can sell you a more expensive system, 10-year life. So basically, you're comparing 3 different lives. And of course, the cheapest system has the shortest life. You can't just divide the cost of the system by the number of years it's going to be around. You have to convert it into an annual cost. This is how you do it. So have your financial calculator. If nothing else, pull it on. Or the payment button on my calculator says, you know what? I'll take the 5-year system. Even though, you know, so basically, you're converting what is a lump sum cost into an annual cost. Any questions? So the next magazine offer you get, I'd like you to convert it into annuities and payments. I know it's overkill, but just give it a shot. In fact, try that out. Is $69 over 3 years really cheaper than 48 over 2 years? And is 48 over 2 years really cheaper than 25 in 1 year? And you know what it's going to depend on? What your discount rate is. If your discount rate is more than 10%, you should always do the 25%. Each year, because the present value effect will more than eat up whatever you save by going into a 2-year or a 3-year life. Any questions on projects with different lives? So we've talked about lots of different ways in which you can assess projects. So let me list them out. If I gave you a project and you're looking at time-weighted cash flow measures, you can look at NPV or IRR, or remember I divided the NPV by the initial investment profitability index. You can stay old-fashioned and go with the return on capital, return on equity, return on invested capital. Or you can even do even more simplistically, just look at payback. How many years will it take me to get my money back? So I want you to think about the choices I've given you. I know you might have just, you still might be uncertain about the specifics. But given what we've talked about, if you had to pick an approach, I want you to pick one. You don't have to tell me. Think about which one you'd pick. So you're the CFO of a company, you have to pick. And then I wanted to ask if that choice could have been affected by a crisis that occurred. In other words, are your choices affected by crises? And I'll tell you why they may matter. In a crisis, what do? You start valuing cash flows more. And the reason I bring that up is in 2009, a lot of companies that had never used payback before started using payback as an additional metric when they looked at projects. Why? Because they were worried of running out of cash. Lots of companies that had never done it before switched from NPV to IRR because they thought of themselves as capital rationed, where they didn't before the crisis. So crisis can change the way you think about projects. But think about these choices, because I'm going to show you what CFOs at U.S. companies pick when they decide what their metric should be. And across U.S. companies, this is what the statistics look like. I haven't found a survey since 98, so it's not like I left the slide in 98. I haven't found any since. But there are some trend lines that are already interesting. By far, the dominant decision variable used in companies to pick projects is internal rate of return. In spite of all the critiques I threw at it, it's the most widely used. Second most widely used is NPV. That wasn't always the case. If you go back to 1976, accounting returns were a lot more popular. They've dropped off. NPV's taken a lead role. Payback actually jumped from 9 to 19%. In 86, when you had a lot of LBOs and acquisitions going on, dropped back to 14%, and about 3% used the profitability index. Yes, sir?
I don't understand why you would use NPV instead of profitability index.
The question is, why would you use NPV as opposed to profitability index? Remember, the one quality NPV has that makes it really useful is that if you tell me what the NPV of your project is, your value as a company increases by the NPV. NPV is additive. Profitability indices don't have that property. But remember, if you use profitability index, you and I probably are going to agree on 99 out of 100 choices we make. There's a very unusual case where you'll get different answers. The only thing you're telling me when you use a profitability index is you have limited capital. And if you're a company like Apple or Google, I probably don't want you to think of yourself as limited capital. So the larger the company, the more you're going to move towards NPV. The smaller and more capital constrained you are, the more you're going to move away from it. Yes?
So one of the reasons you said don't choose IRR...
No, I didn't say that. I said depends on who you are. So let me make sure you know.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you're given the cash flows
for this project. You're not given the cash flows in other projects. And that's my point about IRR, right?
For this project.
For this project. Calculate with the given cash flows, but the assumption is those given cash flows will be reinvested elsewhere. So let's say you have a 10-year project. You have cash flow in year one, year two, year three. The problem with IRR is making assumptions about other projects out there that exist, because the only way you're going to be able to earn the IRR is you take the cash flow you get in year one and year two on this project and find other projects that earn the same IRR. Right? In fact, go back to that page where I showed you the modified internal rate of return. You can see the mechanics of what I'm doing. So that's a standalone project. I give you that one project up front. I say you're going to invest $1 billion. You're going to make $300 million in year one, $400 million in year two. So basically, if you just got those cash flows and compute the IRR, you come up with 24.89%, based just on the cash flows. But implicitly, what I'm assuming also is then the $300 million you get in year one, you're going to be able to find an investment which earns 24.89%. In year two, the $400 million gets reinvested at 20. So every cash flow you're getting on this project has to be reinvested elsewhere and earn exactly the same IRR. And that's where the danger comes in. It's not on this project, but in the fact that there aren't other projects out there where I can reinvest that money. Okay? So think about it. I know it's a little messy, because when you think of cash flows, you're saying, what do you mean? Those are the cash flows in the project. I have no problem with the cash flows in this project. My problem is, what exists out there with the same kind of returns? Because if it doesn't, then I'm overstating the internal rate of return. Okay. Yes? You could, but modified IRR, you're getting very close to NPV. Once you get to that close to NPV, why dance around the bush, right? Just do the NPV and move on, right? So the more modifications you do to IRR, the less allure it has. The nice thing about IRR is a percentage rate of return. You can compute it, you can move on. And the more you modify it, the less you want to use it. Okay. So now let's talk about side costs and side benefits. What do I mean by that? When you take a project and I give you the cash flows, it's not just this the it's not that the project is a standalone project, but if you have a company, there might be side benefits to the company and side costs to the company. Okay? Sounds mysterious, but the side costs could include things like if I start a new theme park in Rio, I might take the theme park manager from Orlando and send him over to Rio because he has a lot of experience. I'm not paying for a new employee, but now I have to find a replacement for the guy who left Orlando. Or I might take a ride that I have in Anaheim and say, you know what, I'll take this Dumbo ride and I'm going to put it in Rio because it's going to work better there. Again, I'm not paying for a new Dumbo ride, but it's something I own already. I'm taking it away from an existing theme park. Those are side costs. What are the side benefits? With Disney, I shouldn't even start listing these out, right? Star Wars movie comes out. I could show you the gate receipts. Gate receipts on that movie are going to amount to about $2 billion by the time it's all done, global release. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, and I've talked about this before. For that $2 billion in gate receipts, Disney's probably going to generate about $8 billion in merchandise, streaming, book, movie, TV deals out of that, side benefits. You can't ignore that. When you do a project, there are side costs and side benefits, and I want to talk about what we can do to bring them into our cash flows and into our returns. So let's talk about some of these side costs. The first cost, I'm going to kind of put this generic term of opportunity cost, but don't get too caught up in naming something an opportunity cost. An opportunity cost arises anytime I take a resource that already belongs to me as a company and use it on a project. It could be a person, it could be an asset, it could be a warehouse, whatever it is. And here's the general rule. If you're using something you already own on a project, it's not costless. You can't just say, I own it already, it's free. Because there is always an alternative use. It could be that you could sell the asset to somebody else and get something for it. It could be that you could rent or lease this asset to somebody else and get rental revenues. Or in some cases, by using this asset, you're denying yourself a chance of using it elsewhere in the company. Sounds mysterious, but let's take the easiest scenario. Let's start with that first, the Disney theme park. Right? It's going to be built in Rio. I didn't mention this, but let's assume that Disney already owns land in Rio. Why they bought it for something else? It's just been sitting around. And if this theme park is built, they're going to actually build a hotel on this land to service the theme park. So they're going to use land that already belongs to them, and they're going to build a hotel on it. If this theme park is built, it'll become part of Disney's offices, so they'll use it. But if this theme park is not built, Disney could sell the land for $40 million. And the book value, what they originally paid for this land, was only $5 million. So here are the numbers you know. You own the land already. You bought it for $5 million several years ago. If you sold it today, you could get $40 million. I'm sitting there doing the theme park analysis of what should I do with this land. So I'm going to offer you some choices. And you tell me which of these choices makes the most sense if I want to make the right decision on the theme park. Okay? So I'm going to use land I already own. I bought it a few years ago for $5 million. But if I sold it today, I'll get $40 million. First choice, I could ignore the cost of the land saying I own it already. First choice. The second is I can use the $5 million. That's the book value of the land, which is what I originally paid. So if I look at my balance sheet, that's what's there. I'm just going to say I'm going to transfer the land, so I'm going to use $5 I could use the market value of the land because that's what I give up by opening this theme park, which is $40 million. Or maybe none of these answers is the right one. So basically, 0, 5, 40, or something else. What do you think I should do? Okay, so let's take it a step at a time. Why not use the argument that I already own it, therefore it has no cost? What am I missing from a fundamental cash flow perspective when I do that? What's the essence of cash flows? They're incremental cash flows, right? What are the two questions you need to ask? What will happen if I take the project? What will happen if I don't take the project? Fill in the details. If I take the project, the land gets used to build build offices for the theme park. If I don't take the project, what am I going to do? I'm going to sell the land. Minute I sell the land, what comes in? $40 million in cash. I don't get to keep the entire $40 million in cash because I paid only $5 million for the land. There's a $35 million capital gain I made on the land. The tax guy is not just going to sit there and just keep the cash. He's going to say, I want my share. In this case, if the tax rate is 20%, he's going to want 20% of the $35 million. See what thinking through the consequence here is. So you're going to get $40 million. You have to pay $7 million in taxes. You're going to have a $33 million lost cash flow because you took this theme park. Now, do you see why I call it an opportunity cost? By taking this theme park, I'm denying myself the opportunity to sell the land and get to keep $33 million. And that $33 million will now become part of my initial investment in the theme park. I'm going to call it opportunity cost of land if I want to be creative. But it's really the fact that I could have sold the land for $40 million and I had to pay taxes of $7 million on that $40 million. Any questions? So you cannot ignore the land, even though it doesn't belongs to you already. You cannot use book value because it's irrelevant. It's not a cash flow. You cannot keep the entire market value because the tax guy is not going to let you do it. So you're going to take the market value of the land and net out the taxes you'd have had to pay if you sold the land. In fact, what I suggest to people is they draw a line down the middle of a page. On the left-hand side, they list out what will happen if they take the project to this land. On the right-hand side, they list out what will happen if they don't take the project. The incremental cash flow is the difference between the two sides. Yes? That's right. You paid five. So you're going to get taxed on $35 million. 20% of 35 is $7 million, right? So that's what I took out of it. You're not going to be taxed 20% on the $40 million. You're going to be taxed 20% on the 40 minus the 5. Any questions? So that's the first example. Let's try something slightly more complicated. Let's go back to that Bookscape, the online retail company we were talking about. Right? Let's assume this online book, the book retailer we were talking about. So let's say the bookstore decides to open an online retail space. So you're the owner and say, work through the cash flows. The initial investment needed to get this process going, let's say it's $1 million, those investments have a four-year life. So basically, you're going to depreciate it over 4 years. The salvage value will be zero. The revenues in the first year are expected to be $1.5 million from the online retail, and they should grow 20% in year two, 10% in the following 2 years, and the costs of the books you'll be selling will be 60% of your revenues. So you get to keep 40% of whatever your revenues are. You'd have to hire a couple of employees for this online bookstore, and that total salary is going to amount to $150,000 in year one and grow 10% for the following 3 years. So that's going to be your biggest cost. And finally, the working capital, which is mostly inventory, will be 10% of revenues, and they have to be made at the beginning of each year. So this is an online retail store you're planning to open, and I've given you the specifics in the store. Let's see what the cash flows are going to be on this online store. Let's start at the top. Okay. Oh, incidentally, before I show you the cash flows, let's do the discount rate for the store because we need that to get the present value. I can't use the beta for Bookscape to do this analysis because this isn't a traditional book retailing business. It's an online retail business. So what I did was I computed the beta for publicly traded online retailers. The beta that I came up with was 3.02. That's the unlevered beta, adjusted for the fact that this is a private owner. So it's a total beta that I'm using. The debt-to-equity ratio stays at 21.41%. With that debt-to-equity ratio, the levered beta that I get for this bookstore is 3.41. Cost of equity of 21.48%. Cost of capital for this online business is a pretty high number. It's 18.12%. Again, I'm not using the cost of capital. I computed for Bookscape as a company because that's a different business. I'm recomputing the cost of capital. That's what I'm going to use as my discount rate for the cash flows in the store. And here's what the cash flows look like. Let's start at the top. Revenues of $1.5 million in year one, growing at 20% in year two, 10% in years three and four. There are my revenues. For my operating expenses, there are my salaries. $150,000 growing at 10% in years one, two, and three, years two, three, and four. The books cost me 60% of revenues. That's $900,000 is 60% of revenues, and it's 60% each year. The depreciation is the initial $1 million written off in four straight line because there's no salvage value, $250,000 a year. I subtract the expenses from my revenues. There's my operating income, $200,000 in year one, growing to $305,000, $360,000, and $421,000. I subtract our taxes at 40%. There's my after-tax operating income. Don't forget, I want cash flow. So I'm going to add back the depreciation. I'm going to subtract out CapEx. So there's my initial CapEx, which includes the working capital. And I get a cash flow and change in working capital. So basically, I have my cash flow each year. Minus 1.15 million, 340,000, 415, 446, and 720,000. I discount them all back at 18%. The net present value that I get for this project is $76,000. Again, I'm focused on incremental cash flows and the discount rate that reflects the risk of this project. But this has so far been a standard. So that's what I have as my net present value. But then I remember two things I forgot to tell you. This particular online bookstore will increase the work that the general manager of the bookstore has to do right now. So he's going to be working more hours, and if I want him to stay on, I've got to pay him a higher salary. So let's assume that I've got to give him a pay hike of $20,000 a year just to keep him on. He says, look, I'm not working these extra hours if you don't give me a pay hike. So because of this bookstore, and that's why it's an incremental effect, or the online bookstore, I've got to give him a pay hike of $20,000 a year. After the fourth year, it's going to revert back to the original salary. Second, there's an office that is right now being used by the bookstore that I'm going to convert to use for the online. So I already own the space, but because I'm using it for the online bookstore, I will now have to move the records elsewhere, and it's going to cost me $1,000 to store them. So I'm laying the foundations for other costs that come to me because I opened this online space. So let's see what effect those two changes have on my cash flows. My salary goes up 20, so this is the manager's salary increase. I get a tax savings when I do this. So there's the present values of the after-tax amount works out to about $34,352. If I look at the additional storage costs I have each year, $1,000, again I get a tax saving because it's a tax-deductible expense. So that's what the 1 minus the tax rate does, $600 a year. The present value of those is $1,610. My net present value with the opportunity cost, with the side cost incorporated, is $76,375. That came from 2 pages ago, $76,375. Minus the $34,352, that's the present value of the salary, minus the $1,610, my net present value with the side cost built in is still positive. So if you ask me, should I open this online retail space? My answer is yes. In spite of the side costs you create for your general manager and your storage space, bringing in those costs, I still end up with a positive net present value. But you can see why this can make a difference, right? If the net present value originally had been only $25,000 and I brought these side costs in, it made this project go from being a good project to a bad project. That's why you need to assess side costs before you jump into a project, rather than let it become a factor that you look at after the fact. I know you're tired, you're almost done, but I'm going to open up a page which might or might not be relevant. Might or might not be relevant, so don't read too much into it for your case. Yeah, Justin.
Go back to the previous slide.
Yeah.
What is the opportunity cost in year 4? Where did you get that?
That's the 13,892 plus the 600. Right, there are two costs. So just add the two costs up.
What was the point of doing this?
I'm just saying, you get the same answer. So you could either do it separately or you do it all in one set of cash flows. You get the same net present value, right? No, but because it already gets done. So when I do the last column, you can do one or the other. Either you can bring it into your rest of your cash flows or do it separately. So last thing I want to do today, excess capacity. Let's assume in the Vale case that I told you that this new iron ore mine is going to use an existing distribution system. So you already own it. So the manager who's pushing for the mine says, well, we already own it. There's no cost attached to it. Is that true? If you have excess capacity in your computers, on your servers, on your distribution system, in your storage space, you use them for a project, what are the potential costs of using some excess capacity? You can't, but right now I don't have another use, so that's going to be my defense. So what are you making use of? Since I don't have another use, why are you charging me? I don't have another use today. What if I have an existing product that's growing, that's using the space, You see what the cost is? By using this capacity now, what have I done? I'm going to run out of capacity sooner. You're saying, so what? When I run out of capacity, there are two things I can do. One is to cut back on production and lose profits on whatever I'm going to cut back on production on. The other is to buy new capacity earlier than I otherwise would have. I can't get any more explicit than that. You think, so what? I'm going to spend $3 million in year 3 instead of year 6. What's the big deal? You've been missing this entire class then. There's a time value to money, right? So if spending money earlier rather than later costs you, it costs you in present value terms, it'll show up through the present value. That is the cost of using excess capacity. Cost of using excess capacity is not that today you're giving up something. Today you're not giving up anything, but because you use up this excess capacity, you're going to run out of capacity earlier rather than later. And in present value terms, earlier rather than later has a number attached to it. And that number comes from the fact that there's a present value investing in year 3 as opposed to year 7. That difference is your cost of using excess capacity. I'll leave you with that thought because right after you leave this class, I want you to go read the case almost immediately. On your way home, on the train, wherever you are, read it while it's fresh and deal with it. I'll see you on Monday. Probably capitalize it.
Should we capitalize
it? The last point you made about the difference in using excess capacity now or later. So when you're actually calculating the cost, it's just about whether. So then again, it's a question.
Do you have to? If it shows up in your cash flows, isn't it automatically done when you do your NPV?
So isn't it just like basically finding out what the incremental cash flow is of using it later
There's no incremental cash flow. You're going to build the capacity. There's not the cash flows that come
through. So that difference is basically incremental, right? Whether you're using it earlier or later.
It's not the using it. It's the spending on the capacity that is incremental later. You're going to use it no matter what. That's not even a choice. The question is, when are you spending to build that new capacity?
You might as well spend it now rather than when you run
out. Why would you do that? Because why spend earlier if you don't need it till year 4? That's.
I mean, yeah, actually, that's
so I have a couple of questions about the project. So you know how you said the rates for servicing are going to be higher than inflation, like 36 domestic and 48 international. For the international ones, would you have to use the international like weighted inflation rate or just the also, when we're doing the a lot of it is like so would we still use the incremental analysis that we're using here for the project?
Well, you might not for offer to meet them,
yeah, ultimately I can get that. But for the cash flow analysis,
because everything you're making investments at the end of each year. If you wait till the end of the year and you see it 100%, you ran out of capacity in October or September.
So like if I was a follow-up question, and this might be like, you know, not part of this class or whatever, should we be using like mid-year conventions or just like...
That's a waste of time. You'll have the same problem, just move to the mid-year. Anytime you have a point in time in which you get the cash flow, you're always going to have an issue. Even if you move to the middle of the year, that problem's not going to go.
So like based on like when you turn off, like we'd have to essentially choose between like which year the 98% capacity and before the of what the expenses are.
You wouldn't pay the cost when you invest it.
Or you have to choose when to invest it.
You'll invest it when you run out of the year before you run out of capacity. It's not a choice. Right? And so you're not going to invest 2 years or 3 years ahead. Why do it?
Are you taking
a couple of our group members left unexpectedly? So we just finished.
the project they got 10 bucks towards you?
Well, what?
Would you want a fourth member? There are a few stories people. Maybe this is the guy who...
Are there?
I would say I do have one guy. I will, you know, I will send his name to you. You talk to him. You interview him. You know, prodding irons or whatever. Find out if he's a kind of person.